This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Michelle is calling me out on my obsession with quite possibly the worst show on television, The Following. It's horrible.
See,
Kevin Bacon can't even redeem it.
This is not a podcast. This is an intervention.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Michelle Gininger of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net, sitting in this week for Mike Petrelli. And now please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Kevin Bacon of Education Reform, Dara Z. Handler.
All right, I know why you called me that. Michelle is calling me out on my obsession with quite possibly the worst show on television, The Following. It's horrible.
See,
Kevin Bacon can't even redeem it.
This is not a podcast. This is an intervention. We have to save you from bad TV.
I recognize that it's horrible. I told Michelle yesterday that I hope they cancel the show because it's so bad. But if they cancel it, then I could stop watching it. And
no, you're a free
and
agent.
Move on with my life.
You have the ability to turn it off. And there are so, like, almost anything on TV is better. I mean, your options are endless.
The irony is that it's not like I have multiple TV shows and this is one of them. I don't even have cable. So the fact that I have two shows, House of Cards and this one. So the fact that this is even on my television watching radar, for those of you listening, don't watch this show. It's awful.
I'm going to get you hooked on The Americans. That's the plan. Because we got to save you. I mean, you're just too intelligent.
A television intervention. Thank you.
All right. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly. Pamela, what do we have first?
This week, Fordham released a new report entitled Common Core in the Districts, which explored how early implementers of the Common Core are attempting to put standards into practice. What did the authors find?
So this is a great report. Everyone has been talking about the politics of Common Core, and this is the first look at how the black box of implementation is actually going. And so we looked at four districts, four very different districts, and in a word, things are bumpy. The exciting thing for me on this is that teachers and principals seem to be embracing the standards and that the standards will be successful or fail with teachers, and we've got teacher buy-in despite some of the union politics that have been going around in the recent weeks. What did you think, Dara?
I think, you know, I agree. It's the implementation is mixed. You have some districts that are having great professional development, but they're struggling with curriculum. You have some districts with awesome collaborative programs for professional development and curriculum and instructional practices in the primary level, but not so great in the secondary level. And so, you know, I think it confirms what we've known all along is that implementation is not going to be perfect, but it's also the districts are not seeing this as yet another thing that is being handed down from on high that's going to, you know, you kind of work on it half-heartedly for 6 months and then it goes back in the closet like everything else that has come before it. There is an intense amount of buy-in on this because despite the fact that implementing it is bumpy and hard work, that the people who are on the ground really do see the benefit in what they're doing. And they recognize that, you know, the standards are better than what they had before, more rigorous than what they had before. Even if they're not more rigorous than what they had before, depending on the state, they're better organized than what they had before. The order of the standards makes sense. And so, you know, I think it's a promising start.
I agree. And, you know, I think the exciting thing about this is, you know, it's classroom level reforms as opposed to systemic reform and that teachers feel involved. And we saw in some of our districts that the teachers had a hand in developing the curriculum that they chose and you know, were doing the professional development and really involved in this. But what the concern is Common Core aligned curriculum. And that is the big question that, you know, I think a lot of people have had concerns about. And so I think we'll just have to wait and see. It's not all there yet. We'll just have to wait and see till our next report. Ba-da-da-da.
No, it is a genuine concern, though. I mean, when I taught, I taught in Washington, D.C., and the standards weren't awesome, but they were fine. You know, the content was fine. The order of the standards basically made sense. But the curriculum and instructional practices that went along with the standards was not there at all. That, you know, it was kind of the assumption that if you have the standards, then the teachers are going to figure it out, especially at the secondary level. So I think with this report, one of the things that we're seeing as a benefit of Common Core is that districts are realizing that it's not just the standards, and the standards aren't enough, and they really do need a direct, deliberate effort in developing curriculum, in training teachers and instructional practices. And if that's something that, you know, we needed to switch to Common Core in order to get, then, you know, we can only see that as a positive benefit.
All right. Question number two.
In response to a growing number of people concerned about the privacy of students in the age of big data, the Department of Education has released new guidance on student data privacy. Will their suggestions be successful?
Politically, no. I mean, I think Matt Richmond in our office nailed this a few days ago when we were talking about this, which is, you know, if the federal government doesn't do enough, then student data and privacy issues will be a problem. If they do too much, that's federal overreach. So I think politically, there's no way for them to win, though. Recent news, Target, Neiman Marcus, data is going to be more and more of a problem. And the question is, what level of government should handle this? And how strict do we want to be? And I just think that there's going to be no way to win this one. It's always going to be, this is too heavy-handed, this is too much, or there'll be a breach and we didn't do enough. We should have done more. So no matter where we go politically, there's just no way to win.
Yeah, I think there's two issues here. Number one is, what type of data do you collect? And then number two is, how do you allow people access to this, right? And states have been collecting tons of student level data for 10, 15 years, and we haven't heard about a data breach yet. And part of that is because they have intense data security protocols. And, you know, the same thing when it comes to something like medicine and clinical trials. Have you ever heard of a data breach happening there? Not really. And the reason is not because they're not collecting the data, but because they have intense data security protocols. We're talking about storing data on computers that are not and have never been connected to the internet. We're talking about offices that are locked with only one key. When researchers are allowed access to the data, it's under similar conditions. People from the For example, from the state of California, will come and visit university professors that they have vetted and given access to student level data. They will visit them in their offices to confirm that they are following data security protocols. So I know that politically, you know, one of the more accessible solutions to this is just to say, well, don't collect as much data, don't link the information. But, you know, I think we've seen that you can collect a lot of data and just be really careful about who you release it to.
You're such a researcher.
I know. You want that data.
You want that data. No, I think that if we're going to have an accountability heavy system, we need the data. And if anyone's a House of Cards fan, you know that, you know, there can be breaches, and there's this whole underworld of folks trying to get this data. So I think we do need rules. We'll see if this is successful. Question number three.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture, for the first time ever, has issued guidelines regulating how food is marketed in schools with the intention of teaching kids to make healthier eating choices. Is this a good move?
I'm so glad Mike is not here so that we can actually talk about this. And I know I'm going to have a view that Mike would not have. I think this is a good thing. I mean, I think health and nutrition for our kids is important. I think, you know, schools should be advertising free. Let's have good, healthy choices for them. Fine. I'm also fine with cookies. Everyone knows I have a thing for the sweet things in life. But when you're in the school walls, there's no need for advertising.
Okay, I have two points of view on this. Number one, Los Angeles about 10 or 15 years ago banned junk food in the schools. There was not a lot of controversy over this. It went over pretty well. Everyone was okay with it. Have there been any actual measurable results in terms of student health? Probably not. Again, you know, when I was teaching, we didn't have junk food in our school, but we had a carry out across the street. So it's not like students aren't getting their sweets fixed. However, putting the nutrition aside and talking in general about advertising in school, I think that it's kind of a mixed bag here, right? I mean, you have schools where they're not getting a lot, they're not getting adequate revenue. And so you sell space on their scoreboard and, you know, you have the Joe's Plumbing buying space on the scoreboard, fine. But then what if you have McDonald's buying space on the scoreboard and they're paying twice as much as Joe's Plumbing? You know, so it's a source of revenue. You know, it's not inviting McDonald's into your school to serve. But I think that there's a difference between offering the product in the school and advertising in the school.
OK, I think that's a convincing argument, especially, you know, here in Metro, there's always been controversies of very political messages. And, you know, they have a rule. If it doesn't say certain words, it's allowed to be up there and that you can't censor the message. So I think we have some perhaps First Amendment things here. I guess there was a recent study just out this week that for the first time obesity has declined among 2 to 5 year olds. And I don't want to see sort of those advances be lost with Snickers bars and Skittles in every child's hand.
Well, maybe you keep going. I mean, the reason that obesity in toddlers declined was not advertising to toddlers, but advertising to parents. So you keep advertising, you know, you keep the information campaign with the parents and, you know, you recognize that if, you know, your students are going to go across the street and get French fries, they're going to do it anyway.
Hey, everyone loves some French fries. Well, that's all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. And now everybody's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Welcome to the show, Amber.
Thanks, Michelle.
So what's your guilty pleasure TV and how can we help to solve it?
All right, Callie, it does really feel like you're really admitting something.
Michelle saved an intervention for me earlier.
All right. So once in a while, I'm known to watch Grey's Anatomy. Just once in a while.
Well, the new, like the recent episodes?
No, I watched like the old ones.
Okay.
I'm just catching up. You know, my husband likes Survivor. Tried to get me to watch it last night.
That's bad.
I cannot get into that show. I'm like, what in the world? It's like the 29th season. I'm like, seriously, people? 29th season. But I mean, he loves it. And he's a guy, obviously. Like, I think guys get into this thing more than women. Like, they really like Survivor. My dad watches Survivor. I'm
they
like, what
like
is up?
The bug eating dirt cover.
If you ever get into a real jam, you know, you'll know how to survive.
I guess. Last night, this woman threw their whole bag of rice into the fire because she was getting voted off the island and it was like a big deal.
No, I think that's how not to survive, actually.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Okay, what do you have for us today?
On to the study. We got a new study out by a quartet of economists, four of them, that examines how well existing pension plans serve charter and urban teachers. The completely unsurprising answer is not well at all. Corey Codell and colleagues study pension plans in Missouri. Missouri is kind of unique because they have three plans. The Kansas City has a plan, St. Louis, and the state system. The state system covers 93%. The other two plans cover 4 and 3, respectively. There's no reciprocity between the systems, which is a huge problem because teachers lose their contributions if they change systems. Three key findings. One, these programs are costly and getting costlier. The employer contribution rate to fund pension benefits in Kansas is 8%, 14.5% for the state system, and 16.5% in St. Louis. Number two, all three are backloaded, which we always know, creates penalties for teachers when they try to move because they basically don't ever reach their peak pension wealth. For example, they estimate that the likelihood of a teacher in Kansas City staying until he or she reaches her pension wealth, peak pension wealth, is 3%. 3%. So basically everyone's putting into this, but the benefits are highly concentrated among very few teachers. By the way, 40% in the state system reach their peak pension wealth, which is higher, but still not that great. Finally, number three, in the state system, roughly 70% of teachers remain on the job after 8 years, whereas that percentage ranges from 10 to 30% in the urban areas of St. Louis and Kansas City. So in these urban areas, you know, no brainer. You're seeing a lot more exits Finally, what else do I want to tell you guys here? Several, they conclude with a bunch of really common sense recommendations that we've heard before, one of which is we need more transparency in how these plans work, and we need to let teachers know, like, this is what you're going to get if you leave this time. I mean, like, you know, just give them some common sense guidelines for what's going to happen based on if they leave after 3, 5, 7, 8 years, whatever.
So this is a huge argument for portable retirement plans, right? That you have, you know, not just in Missouri, but everywhere, where if you have teachers.
Someone shut off their cell phone. I'm getting crazy.
Oh, shoot. Sorry, it's me. Yeah. Weird. That would be
I didn't even know that was possible. Just put it away
from the microphone. It's okay, like.
Oh, my gosh. So, all right. Yeah. Sorry.
I'll play it for you later. Sorry,
it's okay. Do you want me to start over?
Was it doing it? Okay.
Here, just get the camera.
I can take it.
Yeah, there are little packets that are coming down.
I had no idea that was even possible. You know, it's someone breaching our data.
If you ever go to like a TV show, a recording, they're going to tell you to shut up your phone.
You learn something new every day.
Sorry, was it doing it the whole time I was talking? Please tell me.
No. It just started as Dara was
Okay.
starting in there. So I apologize.
It's okay.
Have your rethink your thought.
I got it.
Okay. Go ahead.
So this is a huge argument for portable retirement plans, right? I mean, you have teachers who need to be able to switch between systems. They need to be able to switch between a district school and a charter school. Otherwise, you're going to get teachers, you know, stuck in one of those two systems, especially important when you look at the charters, right? Because basically it encourages brand new teachers to go to charter schools. And these probably are schools that could really benefit from experienced teachers, but experienced teachers aren't going to want to switch because they, you know, don't want to lose their pension investment.
Yeah. No, exactly. And it makes no sense, right? I mean, when you see the disparities between the overall state system and the urban system, I mean, let's get real. These working conditions are not that great. That's why we have such a hard time luring teachers to these places to teach. So the more we can do to keep them there, the better. So, I mean, I don't know. It just seems like such a non-brainer. We've had how many studies now that sort of reiterate these same points and these same problems again and again and again? I don't know. I mean, Dara, are you encouraged? I know you went to a recent pension meeting. Do you think there's going to be any changes around these, you know, systematic things we keep talking about?
I don't necessarily think that the changes are imminent, but what I think perhaps what is more imminent is a switch in communication strategy. Mm-hmm. So we can sit here and we know, you know, these results just support basically what we already know about pensions and the benefits of portability and transparency. But the one group that is not really getting that message are teachers.
That's right.
And the perception is that when you try and switch pension systems, that you're taking money from teachers. Mm-hmm. And so the teachers are really resistant to switching. But if they had a better understanding of the fact that changing systems is incredibly beneficial for them, right, then, you know, perhaps the idea of changing systems could gain a little more traction.
Right. And we've got a new study, not that we're going to plug our stuff on this show, but we've got a new study in the works, right, that's going to help to sort of show teachers this, like how much money you've got to put in before eventually you're going to see the benefits of what you put in versus what you're going to get, which is what teachers don't know, right? And we found out in like some places that teachers are 51 years old, we won't name places before they're actually going to kind of reap what they put in. So
stay tuned
indeed. And no sound effect with that study on. I had a sound effect earlier.
Did
but
you?
We'll keep going. That's all the time we have today. I made it through the show without mentioning my embarrassing TV show, so that's a success on my part. Till next week,
I'm Dara Z. Handelar.
I'm Michelle Gininger at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.